Presentation of the actuarial audit by Milliman. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Could you please go up to the podium?
Or? You can do wherever, whatever you feel comfortable. If you want
to
sit,
I'd be happy
stand.
To be here if you guys can hear us okay.
That's fine.
Great.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
This is Daniel Wade.
Nick Collier. We're here to present the results of the actual audit of the December 31st, 2012 actual evaluation and the 2010 to 2012 experience study as completed by your retained actuary, Siegel Consulting. This is not an accounting audit. This is an actual audit, so obviously our focus is like on the actuarial things. We don't expect to match everything exactly to the T, but we expect to be very close. Actuaries are going to have different opinions, so you're going to see some slightly different opinions, but overall you're going to see really good results here. Okay, why don't you go to the next page. So the purpose of this audit is to review Siegel's actual work and confirm the results of the evaluation and the most recent experience study are reasonable. And we do that by doing a full independent replication of the actual evaluation and a full replication of the experience study, which basically means we do almost exactly the same process that Siegel does, and then we kind of come back and check our results and make sure everything's, you know, lining up well. And if things are different, then we go back and, you know, check our stuff first and then go back and talk to Siegel if there are any differences. There was a little bit of that going back and forth, mainly just because Siegel has obviously a better understanding of your system. We obviously talked to your assistant director, Kurt Schneider, too, to understand the system better. We try to do everything as independently as possible, but there's certain things once you get into the innards of actual work where there's going to be slight differences between actuaries, and we just, you know, need to understand that. So you should have a copy. Our detailed report that looks like this. The purpose of this presentation is to go over the key points of that report, but most importantly is allow you to have any questions, so feel free to jump in at any time. So as I said, the bottom line is everything looks good from an actual perspective. It's just a few areas we just would mention for consideration for the future. The results of the audit show a really good match on liabilities and contribution rates, which, you know, obviously just give the key outcome is the contribution rates. There's no issues that we encountered in the audit that we would consider that would be material. And also the package of assumptions is reasonable. In fact, we really like this package of assumptions. I think it's very, you know, it's very appropriate for the evaluation. Recommendations. As I said, we have no recommendations that would have a material impact. We just have one minor technical recommendation in the calculation of the refundability factors, but that will not have a material impact on the valuation. I'll talk about that later. And as I said, there's just several areas where we just consider changes for the future. Different actuaries are going to have different opinions, so that's not surprising. But these are none of these we really would expect to have a material impact. Going to the next page. For those of you here who were here 5 years ago, you realize we did the audit. Obviously, this is not an audit where we're just coming in just doing the exact same thing, because there was a lot of changes since December 31st, 2007. I've kind of listed them here. Obviously, some of the key changes, obviously, you got your new plans, you got your new amortization method. Obviously, the depooling was a big deal. So we've kind of gone through, we've done everything, but we've all paid particular focus to, you know, these new issues as we went through. With that, I'll kind of turn it over to Dan to kind of go over the nuts and bolts of the actual audit.
I have a question before you do that.
Oh, you bet.
So in terms of the scope of the audit, this is really a replication of what Siegel did, right?
Exactly.
So if it was a true audit, would you drill into certain areas and test?
I mean, if it's a true accounting audit, or?
Well, you tell me.
This is an actuarial audit, yes. We do not make any representation to be accountants. We did some checking, as Dan will talk about. We did some checking on the data, just reasonableness, make sure overall it's reasonableness that, you know, they got, you know, an accountant, an auditor, an accounting auditor is going to go in and they're going to go into the system and they're going to look at individuals. We do not do that. That's not really our domain. We're really checking to make sure the actuarial stuff is in line.
So is it more like a second opinion?
Well, yes, it is a second opinion.
So it's called an audit, but it's really not an accounting audit.
Yeah, an actual audit is the common term, but it it should not be confused with an accounting audit. And accountants, you know, they're invariably going to try and match everything up exactly to the T. That's just not going to happen with an actual audit. There are going to be some small differences that I'll talk about, but everything, as I said, looks real good.
And I just noticed in the notes in the main report that I read the other day, you do a compare and contrast with Siegel, and you find that you're within some 1% or less band expected number, and it looked to me like, well, you're doing the same thing, but you're not really getting behind the number in any sort of an audit fashion to determine, except at a general level, what the basis for that difference is.
What we do is, we have certain thresholds. There's actuaries, and Paul can tell you, say within 5% is reasonable. Personally, if your contribution rates are 40 versus 42%, I mean, you're starting to get, and that's a pretty big difference for employers. I have an expectation that the total liabilities are going to be within 2%. If we're off by more than 2%, then I'm definitely going to look into it. As you'll see, we're off by about 0.5%. So we drill into anything that we kind of feel is material. So we looked at a whole bunch of different things, like, the active liabilities. We look at, each of the different benefit types, each of the different cost groups. We look at all these individual pieces and make sure that all of those are reasonable. But no, we don't go and try and match everything to the dollar. But as I said, the threshold, we're, well within 1% on all the key results. So, we felt, real good about that. That's really good for an actual audit.
So if you had found a variance, I just wanted to kind of complete the thought. So if you find a variance, let's say 4 or 5%, would the scope of what you were asked to do include then looking into the why and drilling in and maybe testing some of those
areas? Yeah, even it was, and if it wasn't, we would want to know. We wouldn't want to come to you guys and say, well, you guys are off by, whatever, and not knowing, because if we're off by that amount, we wouldn't know if it was us or, something Siegel was doing. And So we would definitely want to reconcile any difference of materiality.
And
you'll see on the one issue we had was the refundability factors. These are small things, and I think that might have even slipped through the cracks, except it was somewhere where there was just like one cost group. We were a little further off, so we spent, quite a bit of time working with Siegel and just reconciling that difference.
Okay. Question. So you guys received... Milliman received the same data that Siegel received, correct?
Yeah.
So I totally understand in terms of the percentage variance of the differences in terms of like normal costs and accrued liability and those things. But if you're receiving the same data, how come there's a difference in the number of members?
There's issues. I mean, like on the salary, it's like, new interns get annualized. We might not annualize it exactly the same. On the number of active members, we didn't look into it because I think we were real close, but we did all our kind of editing independent of them, and I know there was a lot of stuff. Like one thing we really looked at was the cost groups, because the data we got from CC Sarah, when we looked at the cost groups, we actually saw some differences. And this is when we went back to Kurt. Well, actually, I think we worked with both Kurt and with Siegel, figuring out, okay, it's like we have this cost group with this many people and this liability, and Siegel has this, and Siegel said, oh, there were some edits done after the fact, and then we went back to Kurt and said, hey, Siegel said these were the changes that were made, and is this reasonable with you? So there were a bunch of edits that take place, and we didn't, we did what we thought were reasonable edits, but they weren't going to be exactly the same.
I understand. Okay.
Nick, just following up on Will's question, it was the one thing that jumped out to me on retirees and survivors in the summary on page 3. There's a 35-person difference I would think that would be pretty pinned down.
I think what you have there is Quadros is one area that some actually, and I think on this one, what we had is some people had multiple benefits. You know, you were a survivor and a retiree, and I think we treated them as separate people, and Siegel treated them as one person. So I think were we actually lower?
Okay.
I'm hoping that's gonna bear out. Yeah, we were actually a little bit lower, and that's because we treated them as one person. Actually, you know, that type of thing. First of all, I like you guys. That's great to ask all those questions. I mean, this makes our job easier to kind of really answer your
Still
questions.
Still some of my thunder, but no.
Yeah. That's fine. So if there's no more questions, I'll turn it over to Dan.
Thank you. So yeah, as Nick alluded to, we really do a full replication. Even though we don't get into every individual, we do look at some individuals, and we do a replication of the same procedures that they do. And there are components, there are inputs that go into an actual evaluation. You have your data, you have your assumptions and methods, you have your assets, and you have your benefit provisions, and you take all of those four items and you put them together, and that's how you're able to develop the outputs, which are, of course, the funded ratio and the employer contribution rates, employee contribution rates, and the actuarial liabilities. And the membership data, we already talked a little bit about our procedure here, but we're happy to talk about it some more. As mentioned, we did get the exact same files that the association provided to Siegel, and they provided to us, and we looked at those, and we compared those results to the CAFR. We also compared the results to what Siegel had, and we also confirmed that all of the data fields that the association supplied were sufficient to be able to do the actuarial calculations that we do. Another audit that we did is we looked at the contribution rates and the actual contributions, and if you take the actual contributions and the actual contribution rates, you can come up with an estimate for the payroll. And that was an estimate we did, and so we felt good about the payroll figures that were being used and that was consistent. That's certainly an area where you need to make sure that the contributions coming in really are what you expect, and that is going to be the case if there is a match there. And we did check some individuals. We checked it in aggregate, and our conclusion was that the data used by Siegel was reasonable. I guess one other thing to note is there were some differences, particularly at first, when it came to the cost group allocations, where we take all the people and we look at how many are in each cost group, and there were some differences there, but we think that was a result of more information on Siegel's part. They asked additional questions to the association if they weren't sure, and then they also had more information from the time of the depooling, and so they had information that we didn't have, and we discussed that with them, and were able to rectify at the end, remedy to our satisfaction the number of people in each cost group. And here are the membership data. We already talked about that. Pretty good matches across the board, some discrepancies in certain issues, but felt pretty good across the board about the data. And so we were able to go forward with the data files that Siegel used for its valuation and use those for our valuation. The actuarial value of assets. Now, this is a multi-step process. As you're aware, you use a smooth methodology for the actuarial value of assets, and it's a 5-year recognition of gains and losses. Technically, it's a 10-6-month period recognition of gains and losses, where 10% are recognized immediately, 20% the next 6-month period, until everything is recognized after 5 years. And that's a calculation that's actually done by the association. And so what we did is we took a look at what they did. You know, given the inputs, do the outputs make sense? Do the inputs sum in such a way? Are they consistent? Is the total for each 6-month period sum to a full year period and that type of thing? And that's the type of thing we did. And I can only assume Siegel does the same thing every year, and we felt good about that calculation from the association. And then another step in the actuarial value of assets is to allocate to the individual cost groups, and that's a calculation that is actually done by Siegel. And What happens there is you have your beginning of year allocation by cost group, and then you have your cash flows in during the year. You have your contributions that come in, both from employees and employers, and then you have benefit payments that go out, and then you end up with the assets for the year after you allocate the earnings on an actuarial value basis to the different cost groups. And given the contributions and benefit payments, we match Siegel precisely, and so the last step was to actually match the contributions and the benefit payments. For the contributions, there are given files for employee contributions and employer contributions by employer and by certain other characteristics that were needed to map the contributions into the cost groups. And so we were able to take that and then allocate those contributions to cost groups. And then what happened is it is very close, but it doesn't perfectly match the total. So the file that we received from the association is very close, but does not match the total contributions that show up on the income statement for the year. And so a small adjustment was made so that the sum of the parts was equal to the total. And after doing that adjustment and doing the mapping, we actually matched Siegel's calculations to the dollar. So that was certainly an encouraging thing. The benefit payments, we received a file with about 90,000 records where it had by each month, by each individual, what the benefit payments were for 2012. And then we were able to allocate those to the different cost groups. Again, the sum didn't quite equal the total didn't quite equal the sum of the parts, so an adjustment was made. We didn't quite match that to the dollar, but we did feel good about our match. We certainly felt that the procedures that Siegel was using made sense, and so we were confident that the assets used in the valuation were reasonable and that the approach taken was reasonable and that the results were also reasonable.
So combining all the stuff Dan talked about, the data and the assets and obviously the assumptions, methods, and the benefit provisions, we performed, as we said, basically an independent valuation. As you see, our total actual accrued liability was $7.72 billion versus the $7.76 calculated by Siegel, off by about 0.5%. And as I said, I usually like to be within about 2% on this one. And within 0.5% is a good match. We're very comfortable with that. We looked at, as I said, by benefit type, by cost group, did about a lot of drill down analysis, and felt very comfortable with what the valuation results were. Moving to the next one, looking at the member contribution rates, we independently calculated the basic and the COLA rates. Found good consistency there. As I said, there's one issue with the refundability factor. There's kind of, you know, we have a few plans that have this sort of refundability factor that's used, and we've kind of seen two different ways of going about it, and we couldn't match Siegel's, and we went and talked to them, and we found a difference. And I think Siegel agrees that really the method that we're recommending, that really they intended to use, well, they should be using, but it's very small, because what you're talking about here is the refundability factor. Say, you know, Siegel calculated 99%, well, maybe it should have been 98%. Well, that gets applied to the COLA, and by the time it all flows through the member rate, it's, you know, going to make it just a few basis points difference. So should be a very small difference overall, but it's one area that we actually, I mean, found a difference that we think that should be changed, but as I said, shouldn't have a large impact overall. Moving to the next page.
Excuse me.
Yeah, sure.
Can you define large, small? I mean, well, dollars.
It depends on how you're looking at it. You're talking about in overall dollars and you know, for a sample member or for the overall county. I mean, so we're talking.
For example, you said a member contribution rate might change by a few basis points.
Yeah, I mean, for an individual or for how that affects the count, the employer's contribution.
I think we have to consider both.
Well, I mean, you know, so I'm going to write this down because I don't want to. We'll take somebody who's making $50,000, and I don't, you know, I don't have all the exact, I mean, it's going to vary by cost group, But if you said, we'll just say 4 basis points, for example, if that was 4%, that would be 2,000. And it'd be, you know, you're talking maybe $20 a year for a member. And then what's your total payroll must be?
We can figure out from the average.
600, isn't it?
600 million?
That's the number I'm remembering.
Yeah, and this one, I think, I can't tell you. I mean, the cost groups, it's gonna depend, because overall there's gonna be some that will be slightly higher and some that will be slightly lower, if it's changed. But you're not talking millions of dollars. You're talking maybe, you know, you're talking in the thousands or hundreds of thousands.
Right.
So are we talking hundreds of thousands?
I don't have Siegel didn't revise their numbers, so I don't have their exact numbers, so I don't know.
That's
if,
on
if
the,
you want that's something
that's
we
on
can,
the refundability is what you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
If you want us to, you know, we can certainly, you know, work with Siegel and figure out, you know what the total magnitude is. If that's something the board desired.
Well, let's go on.
Okay.
When you're calculating, do you use like a cost neutral percentage? Say you're saying like, oh, you look at 2%. Say if you're over 2% or below 2%, is that your cost neutral number? In the sense of looking at each category, as long as you're within a 2% ratio.
We kind of use the material out of, we kind of look at the, you know, if it was, you know, if it's your biggest cost group, it's more than 2%. There's a couple of the real small employers that we were slightly off by more than 2%. And we don't have a magic number. 2% is kind of something I use. Now, when you get in the employer rates, it gets a little bit leveraged because of, you know, the way the unfunded is. If your actual accrued liability is off by, you know, 1%, your unfunded could be off by 3%. So there's a little bit of leveraging in there. So we, you know, take that into account so you don't have a magic number. But I definitely wouldn't want to see any of these numbers being out of the employer rates being, you know, off by 5%. And then I definitely go back and look at it. Okay, we've been talking about funding. Obviously, you guys use the entry age normal cost method. It's one we generally recommend for our clients, provide stable normal cost rates, so we're very comfortable with that. One of our comments from the prior audit we had was just that it used to be under a closed amortization period. So as that amortization period got smaller, obviously it was going to result in more volatility in the employer contribution rates. And I know Siegel, I think, actually maybe talked to you guys about that, actually the meeting subsequent to our presentation. So that was changed to use a layered amortization, and that's what we've recommended to a lot of clients. And using 18 years we think is a reasonable amount. It provides pretty strong funding. In fact, you guys have really one of the stronger funded plans around, but it also provides some balance between the volatility of the employer rates by using a layered method instead of a closed method. So very comfortable with that. Obviously, it adds, having a layered method, having all these cost groups, you know, looking at the report, it obviously increases the complexity quite a bit, but we think it does result in a good funding approach. That's good. Moving on to employer contribution rates. We independently calculated these ones, I said, and as you see, good match. I think all these, but there was one that was off by just slightly, or actually two that were off slightly more than 2%. But as I said, that's slightly due to the way the leveraging works on the employer contribution rate. But overall, we're very comfortable with this, with these matches. We did highlight there was one difference in the methodology for determining the valuation payroll for the, if you got your population right now, so you need to project what the valuation is next year, and the Siegel uses a slightly different method than we would use. So we've just put that as we've kind of t- talk to them about what our method is. We feel like provides a little more consistency with a payroll assumption. Everything's going forward after that year, everything's exactly is, you know, 4%, so we're doing the same, but just that first starting point is a little bit different. So we talk to them and we just throw that out as consideration for the future.
Sir?
Yes.
So these numbers here, you said that like there's that 2.5 percent. You're saying you're comfortable with these numbers. What would be in a percentage variance that you would not be comfortable?
Well, if it was more than 5%,
I'm
sure I would not be comfortable with it.
Depends a little bit on the size of the group, too, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's more ability for there to be more variance.
Yeah, you're going
to
get more. Yeah.
Are you evaluating those ratios? I mean, other than just looking at the numbers, I mean, do you have a ratio of the percentage variance to the size of the group at all? Or
we certainly do look at the the dollar figure difference as well as mm-hmm. the percentage difference. Mm-hmm. So that is implicitly.
So if it approached 5% or exceeded 5%, what would happen to Scott's question earlier? What would happen at that point?
We wouldn't be here talking to you. We would have resolved. Either there would have been a difference between.
There would have been a fight in the back
alley. Yeah, there would have been cage.
We could take
there'd be an actual cage match. No. Yeah. So, but at that point, we would have gone back to see you all, and we would have come here, and hopefully, we've been on the same page. We would have said we think it should be this, and they think it should be that. We would have come. We would have figured out what the difference was, and hopefully, come to an agreement on what it should be, or having different opinions. And okay. But yeah, that didn't occur.
And these variances, is there any industry standard in terms of the variances? I mean, this happens all the time where actuaries.
There's a floating thing out there about 5% difference that was off a corporate it was a corporate threshold, and it's not for actual audits, but some people use it, and as I said, I'm not real comfortable with that. I mean,
yeah.
It's a pretty big difference when you're talking about contribution rates.
Sure. And to your point, sir, is it's 5% of the $1 billion cost group. I mean, that's
yeah,
significant number.
Yeah, if it was 5% of an individual one, but there was a couple of these we were off on, and that gets back to this data issue. There was certain people that once Siegel got the data, they identified when they originally had done the depooling that these people had been allocated to specific things. They'd gone back to the system, asked the questions, and so originally we were off by we didn't this didn't just show up. And then we talked and we figured out where people should be, and we reallocated them by cost group. We were really good in total, so we figured it was something like that, and then we reallocated by cost group, and that's where we ended up here.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take a step back to member contributions for a bit, because I think we've kind of have passed through that. On page 2 of your report, in section 1, you mentioned changes since the last actuarial audit, and there's a bullet point there for terminal pay. Treatment of terminal pay for valuation purposes was revised for members entering the system after December 31st, 2010. And new assumptions were adopted in the most recent experience study. So are you saying that members in the system before December 31st, 10 terminal pay is treated differently?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's treated, you have different assumptions in the valuation.
Okay. So it's our understanding, and we've had some board conversation about this in the past, that the terminal pay is not included in the member contribution rate.
That's how we did it, because that was our understanding too.
Okay. Did that seem reasonable to you as a proper method?
Well, I mean, it's not gonna. There's arguments for and against it. It's not going to get you the money to pay that benefit if people bump up their if people's salary gets bumped up by 10% at retirement. And you've been funding at whatever percentage, it's not gonna do that. But it's not gonna accumulate enough money to pay for that benefit, as it says in the 37 Act.
Right. So therefore, the employer is paying for that benefit.
So the employer is picking that up. Now, I would have to defer to Harvey whether that's right or wrong.
I guess I'm just asking your opinion in your other the way you do things in your other clients. Is that normally the case?
We don't have anyone with a really significant terminal payload, like
thank
guys,
you,
to be honest, but it's I would definitely consider it. I mean, I would definitely you know, I mean, ultimately, I think it would be the board's decision, but I would definitely consider including that.
Okay, because I didn't see that recommendation anywhere in your report, and I was just wondering, your report says that the member contribution rate's pure reasonable, and yet we know that there is this issue out there that we're still waiting to discuss and come to resolution on, and yet we pay for an audit, and the auditor doesn't put it in their report that this could be a future recommendation.
Yeah, I mean that's a good point. I mean, you know, our comment on the member rates were the calculations are reasonable. Honestly, I kind of felt like that was you guys said this decision had been made on the calculation of the rates, and we weren't trying to open up a can of worms, but
yeah, I don't think this decision was ever made. Okay. It was just pointed out to us recently.
Okay, so
it was even there.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's always tough on the scope. I mean, obviously, we know what there's certain things we know we need to cover, and then there's things you start getting into gray areas, and this would somewhat fall into a gray area whether we do that. But I would definitely consider including that as being a reasonable approach, because that's obviously the county ends up, it seems like the intent, was for the members to pay, X portion of their benefit, and they're effectively not accumulating that amount of money. So. So no more questions, I'll turn back to Dan.
So now I'm going to talk about the experience study. In addition to doing a replication of the evaluation, we did a replication of the experience study, and want to talk a little bit about the importance of reasonable assumptions. Essentially, this is a garbage in, garbage out situation. We have the input items, which include the data, which we talked about, the benefit provisions as we understand them, and we talked about that, and the methodology, and the assets, and then the last piece here is the assumptions. And the assumptions are in two broad categories. You have the economic assumptions, and we tend to set those based on global forecasts, and those assumptions are the assumptions for inflation, as well as wage growth, as well as of course, the investment return assumption. And we feel that global forecasts are appropriate for that. I mean, certainly if you look at the investment returns, your assets are invested in the global market, and so it makes sense to look at that. That isn't going to be particular to Contra Costa what some of those returns are going to do. And we do look at the target asset allocation that the system has, and so we do certainly consider that. But like Siegel, we don't generally feel that it makes sense to reflect alpha in the development and the investment return assumption, and so for that reason, we tend to use global forecasts. For wages, we think that over the very long haul, that wages in Contra Costa County will tend to track those of the nation as a whole, not necessarily in the short term, but over the very long term, we're making very long-term assumptions, and it is our opinion that there will be budgetary pressures versus also competitive pressures in terms of getting a high-quality workforce that will balance and will end up resulting in pay growth for Contra Costa to mirror that of the nation as a whole. For demographic assumptions, it's not as easy to do a global forecast. Instead, you really do need to get in the nitty-gritty of what has been the experience for this particular system. Obviously, the people are different and the benefit provisions are different, and people make reactions to that, and we can see what's happened for the particular system, and that's generally the approach that we recommend using, and that is the approach that Siegel has used.
I had a question for you.
Yes.
Going back to the economic assumptions,
mm-hmm.
do you have an opinion about whether 7.25% is reasonable or could be lower, could be higher?
We think it's a reasonable assumption. We think it's a very reasonable assumption, and we'll talk about that a little bit as we move forward. But we do think it's a reasonable assumption. We have a couple of comments to make about that. But,
do you think it could be lower?
I was going to answer yes to your question when you said, is it reasonable? Could it be higher? Could it be lower?
Yeah. Now, I think that given the inflation assumption that's being used, I think it's very reasonable. And you certainly, if you want to compare it to other systems, not that that's necessarily the perfect way to measure it, but if you want to compare it to other systems, you'll see that you're kind of ahead of the curve, really, to be at 7.25.
No, I know where we are. I saw the chart. I guess I'm asking you, could it be lower?
It certainly could be lower. I mean, it depends upon what type of risk you want to take. It depends on if you're taking the building block approach and you're going with, a lower inflation assumption. Building block approach is where you look at real returns on top of inflation, and that's something that's discussed in the actuarial standard of practice number 27 that deals with these issues. It's actually not in the new version of the actuarial standard of practice, but that's an approach that is often used and was used here. And given that approach and a 3.25 assumption for inflation, the 7.25 seems very reasonable. And I wouldn't necessarily, under that set of assumptions and that philosophy, recommend a lower rate.
Yeah, and I'd say that, I think your inflation could be a little bit lower.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I think your report indicates, you indicate it's on the high end. So if the inflation were to lower, then you're using the building block approach, your rate of return is going to go lower.
Well, you've got a little bit of margin there. I mean, that if you under the building block approach, you're well above, a little bit above 7.25. But yeah, there is a correlation there. One of my clients, basically when you're hearing from investment consultants, they're talking 10-year time horizons, and those are going to be lower. Because there's a short-term expectation of inflation they've built in, so they have very low bond returns. Also, obviously, the market, did really well last two years. So therefore, there's some built-in expectation that it's not going to do as well in the short term. So I do think even though your investment consultants may be telling you 7% or whatever, that there is some reasonable, we're doing this long-term assumption, have a slightly higher. We have one of my clients, their investment consultant has a 30-year time horizon, and they told them that in the short term that they were expecting 6.7, but like a 10-year horizon, but over a 30-year they were telling them 7.9, which personally I thought was high, but I think there is some reason that even if you're hearing this 10-year capital market assumptions will give you slightly less than 7.25, I think there is some reason that the longer term to have that having an assumption that's slightly higher is okay. But yeah, we're definitely comfortable with 7.25. Our other ones are 7.5, 7.75. I've been talking about going a little bit lower.
Yeah, we had one just changed to 7.25. So it's, obviously you mentioned, Scott, that.
Do you have any below 7.25?
Pardon?
Do you have any below 7.25?
I have some that are using 3.75, but the caveat that they don't have any assets.
Zero is probably a better number.
I think 7.25 is for large systems, kind of the biggest in our office. And the other thing is kind of looking at holistically, your employers are putting in a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have your funding. Your funding method is a pretty strong amortization. The amortization is a lot stronger what the system is doing. I've got Lacera. They're at 7.5. I strongly pushed for them to go lower because they have a 30-year amortization. So, looking at kind of that total picture, they're, if you're kind of pushing things off in the future by having a longer amortization period, and then if your investment return assumption maybe slightly on the high side, then you really need to think about lower, whereas you guys have very strong funding, so very comfortable. I mean, I wouldn't recommend probably lowering it just because of that reason. But you could definitely make a case for having a lower assumption, but that's one of the reasons I'm very comfortable with 7.25.
So we talked about this a little bit, but I'll talk about it a little more. The price inflation assumption at 3.25, and as we mentioned, that is a little bit on the high side compared to other forecasts. There, I know that Siegel likes to look at history, and certainly history is the only real data we actually have, so it makes some sense to look at history. One thing they do is they do rolling 30-year averages, and One thing that does is it does count 30-year information more times than recent information, and you know, so that's one thing to consider. Investment consultants make projections for CPI, and that's typically between 2 and 3%. 3% definitely on the high end there, but and some are as low as 2%. And I think a lot of that is informed by what you see for in the TIPS market, where you can look at, well, what are Treasury yields versus what are yields on TIPS, Treasury inflation protected securities, and have kind of an implicit break-even point. Those were at about 2.4 at the time that that Siegel did its analysis. Right now, they're at about 2.3, and so that would be another conceivable mark for inflation. I know our investment consultants at Milliman use 2.5. Social Security, now this one thing that's nice about using Social Security is they definitely have a very long-term approach, and they have a range from 1.8. They have their low-cost method, intermediate-cost method, and high-cost set of assumptions, and their intermediate is at 2.8%, which again is lower than the 3.25. And to compare it to peer systems, 3% now is the most common for public systems, and there's definitely a downward trend. It was a time not that long ago where we talked about 3.5 being the most common, and now it's down to 3, and you can see even some in California. And I should also mention that even your own system dropped it from 3.5 to 3.25 as a result of the last experience study and the discussion that took place at that time. Wage growth, this is typically and is here linked to the inflation assumption. 4% is used, that's 0.75% higher. That's right on top of what history tells us it's been over the last 5 or 6 decades, and so we certainly don't have any problem with that assumption. The investment return assumption, so what we used was Milliman's capital market assumptions, and then used the association's target asset allocation. And then we also used the building block approach and a 3.25 inflation assumption. So we actually did an upward adjustment from our standard assumptions, because our standard assumptions have a 2.5% inflation adjustment and inflation expectation, added the 75 basis points there, and where we resulted as a median is 766. And just one caveat there is that if we redid it now, it'd probably just be ever so slightly lower. Some of the expectations for equity returns have dropped simply because the PDE ratio is such now because of the run-up in 2013 that some think there will be a bit of a regression to the mean. I don't think they're largely different right now, but I just did want to mention that you know, if we were to do the analysis now, it would probably be slightly lower. I alluded earlier to a new actuarial standard of practice, ASOP 27, which deals with the economic assumptions for pension valuations, and that may have an impact on future recommendations because there are some changes that are made there. I mean, they've gotten rid of the concept of the reasonable range. They don't talk about the building block approach, so there will be a different analysis that may take place at the time of the next experience study. Bottom line here, we feel 7.25 is a very reasonable assumption, taking into consideration all the aspects that go into this setting of this assumption. And also did want to highlight that some are still at 8, some are 7.75, but the trend is definitely downward, in large part because of where fixed income yields are, but also just expectations across the board are dictating that it makes some sense to lower the assumption, and the association is ahead of that.
So. Out of curiosity, you mentioned that you had one that was somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.25 or 3.5. Was that a public fund or a private fund?
We have public funds, and we have, these are small city funds. Some of them literally have zero assets, and you know, so it's almost a misnomer to call it the investment return assumption. Well, it is a misnomer to call it the investment mm-hmm. return assumption. It's the discount rate that we use to discount future benefit payments to today's dollars. We also have some that are just have very restrictive, you know, they can't invest in equity. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at the expected return on assets, you know, there's just no way to get there from a 2.5% inflation assumption. You can only get so far if you're not investing in risky assets. So,
okay.
Yeah, it seems like we have our systems where there is a desire to pay the entire annual required contribution and to get fully funded at a time in the future. And when we do that, and they're invested in risky assets along with more fixed income assets as well. And for those, we're usually between 7 and 8. And so I do have some other plans where they have restrictions on how they can be invested, and some that literally have no assets at all. So.
Yeah, that makes returns really tough.
So I'll talk a little bit now about the demographic assumptions, and first we want to give you just a quick methodology example so you can understand the terms that we're using. Over the three-year period, there was a, and I should highlight, there's actually a mistake on this slide, bonus if anyone finds it, just kidding. I'll get to that. There were about 450 exposures, people who were women retirees who were age 67 at some point during the three-year period. There were about 450 of those, so we call that 450 exposures. The mortality rate at age 67 for females is about 1%, so the expected deaths, 1% of 450, in other words, 4.5, the actual deaths were 4, so the actual expected is actually 89%, it's 4 divided by 4.5, for some reason did the expected actual here. The actual is the integer number, and we didn't have 4.5 actual deaths, we had 4 actual deaths and 4.5 expected based on the assumptions. So that's something that we use, that's a technique we use, not just for mortality, but for all the other assumptions as well, to see what the actual experience has been over the three-year period versus what would be implied by the assumptions used. And so I'm going to talk about mortality. Here you can see that our data matches quite well. You have actual 413 compared to 412 over the three-year period. And you see the expected based on the current assumptions also very much in line, so that gave us some confidence that the mechanics of what they were doing made a lot of sense. Another thing to highlight is the basic structure of coming up with a standard recent table, but then projecting it and using offsets is the same type of approach that we typically use, and that is typically used in the public sector actuarial world. Also, I had a quote here that I liked. I think it's kind of interesting. There are those who are arguing that maybe we should consider immortality as an assumption, and this Ray Kurzweil of Google says that some of us will make it through, and I thought that was interesting. There was an article about him that I read, and I thought that was an interesting line and an interesting perspective, so I threw that in there.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's...
there's another line. Nobody gets out of this alive.
Some good arguments, I'll have to admit.
Make it through.
But, one thing to highlight is that you ended up with an actual to expected ratio of 109%, and that sounds like it's pretty good. It does have a healthy margin, and it is good, I think, to have a margin because it does allow for future improvements, not future improvements all the way to what Ray Kurzweil says, but that would be very hard on retirement systems. But certainly, we do expect there to be improvements along the way, and for that reason, we typically have a slightly higher margin, although it is good to see a margin and to see a 9% margin. One other reason, aside from future improvements to mortality, and what I mean by that is somebody born in, say, 1960 will have a higher life expectancy than somebody born in 1940, for instance, even, you know, given once he gets to age 65, once the probability he gets to age 80, that type of thing, we expect that there have been in the past benefit mortality improvements and are anticipating that those will continue into the future. Another thing to highlight is that if you do it on a benefit weighted level, you'll find that people with higher benefits actually tend to have longer lives than people with poor benefits. And so even if the number, the head count, and the number of people dying matches precisely, you would still have some actuarial losses because the people with the bigger benefits would be living longer than the people with the smaller benefits.
Yeah, one way to look at that is if you just had a two-person system, one person having a $500 benefit and one person having a $5,000 benefit, obviously you could project how long they're going to live. And if, you know, the person with the $5,000 benefit lives 2 years longer, the person with the $500 benefit lives 2 years shorter, on average you may work out the same, but that person with a $5,000 benefit is going to have a much bigger impact. Therefore, when we look at this, we have looked at that impact of the higher benefits. And as Dan said, people with higher benefits do tend to live longer, just, you know, a year or so, but it does make a little bit of a difference. So that is one of the reasons we try to have a little bit higher margin.
And one last item I did want to note is that there is a new study from the Society of Actuaries that suggests that the, particularly for females, that the benefit improvements that currently get projected may understate the, not benefit improvements, mortality improvements, excuse me, which of course in turn results in more benefits. But the mortality improvements may be accelerating more rapidly than the current tables predict, and that would be another reason to have a little higher margin.
Sorry, can you give me the name of that study, or do you happen to know?
So there's a scale BB that's out there. So scale BB, and then there's the MP 2014.
Yeah, it's from the RPEC committee.
Yeah, you can definitely retired. Google terms like RPEC and MP 2014, yeah. And in all seriousness, you will find it.
Yeah, it's retired pensioners 2014 is the new mortality table. Now I would say that so they got all this data together to do the study, and then they threw out a bunch of it, and part
the
of the data,
of it.
Yeah, the majority of it, that included public sector employees, because they're unique. Well, because you had teachers, firefighters, and so they threw them out there. So this study does not reflect public sectors. Now, obviously, there's going to be some correlation with public sector and private sector employees. So our takeaway from it was that just that there are this one thing that always concerned me about the existing table and the projected mortality improvements was that males actually are supposed to catch up and pass females in life expectancy, and I would think maybe there would be a narrowing of the gap. So this new study, basically, as Dan said, they're projecting greater improvements for female is really the main gist of it. So it's just something we're looking at, and just something we need to consider when we're setting our tables.
Yeah, and I have one thing to add. It actually is fairly controversial in the world of pension actuaries I guess actuaries in general, the new table, and it is new. But certainly the trend of increased longevity for females, and like you said, I mean, the current tables, you can figure out when they'll actually cross, whereas we think that there certainly has been a narrowing, and you'd expect that to continue. You wouldn't think we'd come to a day where men are outliving women. That certainly doesn't seem like it. And it's far off, but it's out there, and then just the current methodology could be called into question.
So now kind of getting into the rest of the demographic analysis, we looked at merit salary increases. If you remember, merit is salary increases on top of the general wage growth. Basically, this chart shows our results. We also compared them with Siegel's. I don't have them on this graph just because it was getting a little busy, but you can see the blue bars are the actual increases on top of the general wage growth. Compared to the assumption, you see the actual are generally greater than the assumption. Siegel only made, I think, a very small adjustment, and we agree with that. We think this is somewhat of an odd period, because when we talked about a general wage growth, I think you guys are probably aware with the county actually had kind of a cross-board decrease is our understanding. So instead of having general wage growth that we were adjusting for, we were adjusting for a general wage decrease. And we've had a lot of our clients have had like flat over a period, and it seems like when there's almost no cross-board increases, sometimes the merit's a little higher. So this result didn't surprise us, and we thought the way Siegel handled it was appropriate, so we think the assumption is reasonable. Going to the next one, which is service retirement. And this one is, I believe, was also impacted by that county wage growth. I think you had, I mean, as you can see from this graph, once again, the blue is our actual results. You can see, at age 50, we had about 10% of the people retiring, and comparing to the red line, which is the expected, and we also have the green line, which is the actual results reported by Siegel. You see both of our results are definitely much higher than the red line. Once again, our understanding is there may have been, because of the wage growth, there may have been a push for people to retire because they were actually getting lower pay and, you know, they could move into retirement and theoretically maybe get COLAs. So I think there makes sense that there would be, you know, if people were waiting, this was the time. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out next time. If these rates return to normal, it may actually drop less, depending on how that works. But once again, Siegel only didn't overreact and make a huge change. We'd definitely like to see another 3 years data before making, you know, assuming that this was really the new normal. So once again, I think with the assumption is appropriate, and but obviously it should be reviewed next time to see how it plays out. Disability retirement, I'm going to spare you that. Basically, we match Siegel's numbers, pretty darn close. The only thing is, as Dan talked about, actual expected, we had fewer than were expected, but you don't have a large observation, so probably look at that next time. I'm sure Siegel will look at that closely and maybe consider lowering it if this trend continues. But once again, they didn't make a huge change based on a short-term possible fluctuation. Going to the next one, what we call termination, and sometimes I think Siegel may refer to withdrawal, some actuaries refer to that, but basically when we call termination, that's basically leaving active employment for reasons other than death, disability, or retirement. It could be voluntary or involuntary termination. You see our results. Once again, the blue bars are our results, the green bars are Siegel's results, and the red bar is the assumption. Very comfortable with the assumption as it is. There was just one thing that we put as a consideration of the future is once you get past 20 years, you can see the observed was actually less than 1% probability of leaving the active workforce versus the assumption is close to 2%. We've seen sort of a steady decline. Once you get in probability of leaving the workforce after, you know, 20 years, it even goes down even lower after that. So we would just recommend that Siegel look at that closely to see if this trend continues and maybe extend that out a little bit longer to see lower rates after 20 years of service. Going forward, we pretty much looked at every assumption and did an analysis where we could, or did comparisons with other retirement systems. Just a couple I'd highlight here. One obviously is terminal pay. That's a big deal. Siegel did their analysis based on some pay data that was provided by the system. We kind of tried to do this one independently and looked at, you know, what ultimately is the key of the terminal pay. What does it do? It increases benefits. So we looked at individuals, you know, in their year prior to retirement, and then their year of retirement, and look at what their actual benefit was. So we projected what their expected benefit was, and then we looked at their actual benefit and did a comparison, and figured that the difference there was going to be, you know, pay being higher than expected. So we did that analysis, and so looked at. We came up with our own what we call terminal. What came up with our own terminal pay assumptions, or you know, experience, and then compared to what Siegel's assumptions were. And for all the employers of any size, where we had more than 10, or I think it was more than 10 or 15 people who retired during that period, we were pretty close. So we felt that terminal pay assumptions used by Siegel were reasonable. Then the last one, this is definitely not a material issue, because the number of deferred safety members aren't that, there's very few of them, but for safety members who are currently in deferred status, who are going to be in deferred status in the future, basically the new plans, but the folks who can get the 3% of 50, the current assumption is people wait until age, safety members wait until age 54. Well, given that they can retire at age 50 with full benefits, we think 50 would probably be a better assumption. Now, there are some people who have reciprocal benefits, and they obviously may wait longer than age 50, but we think it'd be a little more conservative to assume age 50 to avoid getting any losses don't want to add too much complexity there to split reciprocal and non-reciprocal, but just by using 850, we think would prevent any future losses on this. But once again, I think the number of deferred safety members are less than 100, so it's not going to have a huge impact on your results, but it's just something we recommend consideration for the future. Okay. So just summarizing the recommendations, which I went through, for recommended changes for material impact, there were none. Just that one other recommended change for future valuations, which is the calculation of the refundability factor. And then the four considerations that we called for future were having a slightly higher margin of mortality rates that Dan talked about, earlier benefit commencement for deferred safety retirement, which I just talked about, lower termination rates for those with more than 20 years of service, and then a revised methodology to determine the fiscal year payroll used in the amortization schedule.
Question for you.
Yeah.
Back to terminal pay.
Yeah.
The report at page 48, I just want to try to make sure I compare it to what I heard. I'll give you a chance to get there. Under that particular item, the second sentence says, we did not have complete data isolating the terminal pay component, but we estimated the amount of terminal pay at retirement by analyzing the expected benefit, etc. So what data didn't you have?
Well, we didn't have, when somebody retired, we didn't have, I'm not sure if we had their final compensation, but we didn't have their final compensation. It was due to terminal pay, or you know, we just had what their final compensation was. I'm not sure if we had that. We might have just had their benefit amount.
I'm just trying to understand the conclusion based on whether or not you really had the data to draw the conclusion.
Well, I will say, and I mean, to a certain extent, the fact that we used a different approach and still ended up in the same ballpark is actually encouraging because we looked at what were the expected benefits a year before you actually retired versus what were the benefits when you retired and found the result, which is really what you're trying to project when it comes to projecting out future benefit payments. You're really looking at how much of a spike is there in the final year. And so because we actually took a different approach and still ended up with similar results, that to me was actually encouraging and actually made me feel that much better about the assumption.
Yeah, I go back to what Dan said exactly. He says, I mean, that's ultimately the whole point of the terminal pay assumption is that so you're funding for what the benefit is actually going to be, and you know that salary is a big component on. So that's what we did. We looked at what the benefit actually was compared to what it was expected to be, and that difference was attributable to terminal pay.
So, I'm still trying to figure out. You didn't have complete data. I mean, what was it that it wasn't provided? Did you ask for it? I'm trying to understand the basis for your analysis.
Okay. We didn't ask for, you know, looking at individuals to find out how their benefit was broken down. I mean, we had complete data on the benefit amounts, and we had complete data on their prior year compensation and service, so we were able to project their benefit amounts. But we weren't able to go into their benefit amounts and say, well, you know, we couldn't look at everybody retired and said, hey, their compensation was made up of this percentage of terminal pay and this percentage of pay that wasn't terminal pay. So we sort of had to back that out. And that's how, and we did it by saying, what's the expected benefit amount compared to the actual benefit amount? And since we pretty much know what the service is going to be, we know what their age is, we know what their age factor is, so we can calculate the benefit. So the basic conclusion is that any difference in the salary is related to terminal pay. Now, it's not going to be exact, but we felt it's a very good approximation of what it was. And it's also, as Dan said, a good approximation of what you're actually trying to figure out, which is how much benefits are going to go up at retirement.
Yeah, I guess I was still back at the question. Was this one where you wanted to replicate it but couldn't, or just chose to do a different analysis?
The latter.
Okay. That's not clear, just so you know when you read it.
Appreciate it. All right. So in conclusion, as you probably figured out, really very favorable results. I mean, I've worked on probably close to 50 audits, and we think the actuarial aspect of this retirement system and the work done by Siegel is very good. I just highlight three things. Obviously, Phillip's very accurate calculations. Obviously, very complex system, so that's very positive. The strong funding of the system, and by going to the layered method, balancing out the volatility in employer rates, so we're very much like that. And obviously, reasonable assumptions. In particular, we feel real good about that 7.25% investment return assumption. That it's a good, reasonable reflection of future experience, and I think it's appropriate for budgeting.
And that concludes it. You have anything to add, Dan?
Well, I just like to. Well, certainly won't take any more questions, but I'd like to thank you for your excellent questions along the way. Thank you for the project. It was definitely an interesting project, and I enjoyed working on it. And I also want to give credit to Siegel, as long as they're here. I wouldn't do that if they weren't here, but as long as they're
here. We hate to do that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Brian, I would like to just have the discussion again about when we're going to actually, this board is going to address the terminal pay contribution rate split between employer and employee, or member and employer.
There may not be a discussion to have, depending on lawsuit outcome. So. Yeah.